up front on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us today. October 10th is World Mental Health Day, and today we want to bring attention to the often overlooked link between HIV/AIDS and mental health struggles, including the alarming rates of suicide and suicidal ideations in African countries. And joining me is Brian Ahimbisibwe, the Global Youth Ambassador with the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation. Brian is HIV positive and part of the first generation of young people who went on to live with HIV and not die from it. But today he finds that many of those young people who have lived with the virus all their lives are dealing with social stigma, struggling to find love, find jobs, and many other things in society. He tells me that he wants to spark the critical conversations and promote psychosocial support for young people, ensuring that the mental health needs of those living with HIV are no longer ignored. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Ahimbisibwe. I wanted to ask you, what are some of the mental and emotional challenges faced by young people, by youth living with HIV in Uganda and other parts of Africa?
So most of the challenges and mental health related challenges faced by young people living with HIV in Uganda are depression, anxieties, the fear of the unknown, and as a program officer specifically supporting a psychosocial support with the EGPAF Uganda Country Office, but also as an ambassador who has lived this experience, I've seen firsthand from my own self, but also from the young people in the EGPAF's area psychosocial clubs that I support.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you start into this work? How did you get involved? Why are you passionate about this?
I'm an ambassador for the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation, but also supporting the country program for their area psychosocial support clubs as a program officer. And this work is so passionate to me because I have lived this experience before, and this in a way has built the INMA to support other young people growing up, not to face similar experiences, but also to see them have better health outcomes, specifically for their mental health and psychosocial support needs.
Mm. What are some of the misconceptions or harmful stereotypes about living with HIV that contribute to this stigma?
There are so many, quite a number, but the most outstanding are that living with HIV, young people want to grow up, to live meaningful lives, that they won't have children, that they will be able to run mad at some point because of the medications that they take, that they won't have kids of their own, that they can be able to transmit the virus even with the treatment options available. But then also that there's a cap or maybe a life expectancy that specifically is for people living with HIV and not with the rest of the population. So that's a handful of the many myths and misconceptions.
Yeah. And why do you think this link between HIV/AIDS and suicide among young people is often overlooked or under-discussed?
I mean, one, it's cultural. It's cultural. Growing up in rural southwestern Uganda, you had access to health services, you'd have meds, you'd see a doctor, but rarely would you have access to psychosocial support and mental health services. I mean, for the rest of the health outcomes, it's a health provider initiated, but with the mental health and psychosocial support, until the client reaches out to a health service provider or until the situation is there, it is not so common that a mental health assessment is done through the routine clinical or health facility visits.
Mm-hmm. And what do you believe are some of the key components of creating safe and supportive environments for young people living with HIV to speak openly about their mental health?
One, it is through Streamlining mental health and psychosocial support services in the Ministry of Health guidelines, but also having the data about mental health and psychosocial support, which is right now scanty. The availability of data collection tools, data dashboards to track mental health and psychosocial support service trends, but also to inform real-time programming for healthcare workers and therapists and counselors that offer these services, but most importantly for this young person who is in need of such a service.
And you, in your experience, how can peers or friends or family members support young people living with HIV to reduce this feeling of self-harm or suicidal thoughts?
By providing access to mental health services, but also having to train and equip health service providers, so that I mean these are the people that they see routinely through clinic visits, other than just waiting for a professional therapist who might not be accessible anytime that they want them to. So if these services are able to be layered down to even the routine healthcare provider, but also for health facilities across the country and not just the urban centers, this would be able to equip the young people living with HIV to access services, but also importantly, embedding it in their youth peers that they relate to on a day-to-day basis, and integrating and embracing technology. Young people are so much into technology. And so if there are apps or regular information about mental health and psychosocial support that is running on social media, which is a thing lately, integrating mental health and psychosocial support in artificial intelligence. So this information doesn't have to be rocket science, but even a young person can access it anytime, any day they want to, the same way they access any other health services.
In case you're just joining us, this is Upfront on the Voice of America. We're chatting with Brian Ahimbisibwe, the Global Youth Ambassador with the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation. Brian says that he wants to spark that critical conversation to promote psychosocial support for young people, especially those living with HIV. Can you share some of the success stories or positive outcomes from these psychosocial support initiatives?
So the EGPAF's area psychosocial support clubs offer one-on-one support, mental health support to these young people. But over time, we've realized that the world has evolved with technology. And so we've created online platforms where young people can access these services, but also to give them the confidence to reach out anonymously without the fear of being able to be identified. But also on the receiving end, a young person will be confident enough to reach out without the thought that, oh, maybe people will think I'm suicidal, which is also one of the stigma drivers. So being able to offer a virtual psychosocial support option for young people has been one of the key innovations.
Mm. And what role do you see young people playing in advocating for improved mental health resources for people living with HIV/AIDS?
So when young people are trained and equipped with this information and the right information about mental health and psychosocial support, it is easier to use them to spread it out to their peers. Unlike them looking out for these adult therapists or counselors, it's easier to spread it through the young people within themselves by equipping and training youth mentors and peers to do that.
Mm. And finally, Brian, If you could change one thing about how mental health is addressed in HIV care in Africa, what would it be?
One, I would structure the mental health programming with the Ministry of Health, right from structuring the data, developing dashboards, having routine reporting on mental health and psychosocial support services, having data collection tools, and then providing access to these mental health services the same way it's provided for other health outcomes, developing dashboards that track real-time interventions for mental health, but also provide access to information about mental health services for everyone.
Brian Hambisube, thank you so much for taking time to chat with us today.
The pleasure is mine, Jackson, and thank you too for hosting me.
That was Brian Ahimbisibwe. He is with the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation. He joined me in studio at the Voice of America. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Welcome back. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. African leaders who attended the recently concluded United Nations General Assembly in New York highlighted some of the challenges of meeting the Sustainable Development Goals, SDGs, by 2030, particularly in the areas of climate change, poverty reduction, and others. While addressing the General Assembly, Nigeria's Vice President Kashim Shettima emphasized his country's determination to build a resilient economy and his government's dedication to expanding renewable energy initiatives to achieve clean and affordable energy access in the country. Nigerian researcher and economist Evelyn Dan-Epele, who was in New York to attend the General Assembly, tells me that despite these efforts, Nigeria's economic outlook remains bleak, grappling with soaring inflation and high unemployment, and that's despite the significant financial inflows from the Nigerian diaspora, which sent over $20 billion in remittances in 2023, one of the highest in sub-Saharan Africa. She joins me in studio. Evelyn Dan-Epele, welcome back to the Voice of America. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you
on this rainy day in Washington, D.C., on your way from New York City, attending ANGA, the UN General Assembly. Was this your first time at ANGA?
This was my first time officially covering ANGA, but it was my third year back.
How was it? How is it covering ANGA?
Oh, my God, Jackson, it's a lot. And I don't need to tell you, New York is a lot already.
I've been there during ANGA. I've covered ANGA before, but I want to know from
I mean, you were recently in Nigeria and in Lagos, so you can compare and contrast.
Yes,
being in New York is a lot like being in Lagos.
Absolutely.
And I'm more a Washingtonian, which is more like Abuja, where I live. So I struggled a lot with like a lot of people and the hustle and the bustle.
Throwing at us. New York, Lagos versus Abuja and
Washington,
D.C. So people look it up. anyway, so it was chaotic. I imagine more so during this time because of all the heads of state and government leaders that are in New York. So the traffic must have been crazy. It's rainy. But you have to do what you have to do.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying?
For the first time, I wished I was the president so I could have my own convoy and not walk 10 blocks.
The first time, everybody wishes that every day.
Oh, really? It was my first time. I was like, I should be a president now.
There's a lot of perks. There's a lot of perks.
A lot of perks.
That are attached to that title.
Yeah.
But so let's talk about some of your highlights. Let's start off with your highlight for UNGA. What did you do? What are some of the meetings you attended?
So for the highlights, I would say that The fact that President Tinubu was not on ground at Onga, as Nigerian, and I was covering Nigeria, I observed that that really impacted like the enthusiasm of Nigerians on the ground. I don't know how many people would want to admit that, but there was just something a little different about the dynamics. You had a lot of people saying like, oh, people made a lot of reference to President Tinubu is not on the ground, and they were just like, ah.
And for you, especially you coming all the way to cover it, there was hope that you could cover the president here in New York.
Exactly, exactly. But the vice president was here, so there was something to cover. But I think his absence was definitely felt.
What are some of the things or some of the issues that the vice president covered on behalf of the president, behalf of the country?
We would come to that. It was conversations about debt, sustainability. But, you know, events that I, you know, went around, I was very specific about the events that I go to because there's always a flurry of activity.
Yeah, there are like hundreds of events. So you have to
be very careful to choose. We will talk about that in a bit, which is talking about day one, where I just attended the high-level week, especially because that's where the heat of the conversations happen. So I was concerned with issues like how far are we doing with the realization of the SDGs. I was concerned to know what Nigerians are doing in the diaspora and the impact they're making at home and mediating that relationship. And I also looked around to see how Africa is also faring in comparison to the rest of the world.
Okay, so let's talk about the SDGs. How are African countries, let's talk about, I guess, the conversation around this. How are African countries, particularly Nigeria, working to accelerate the realization of the SDGs? What are some of the things they're doing?
One of the things I would say that Nigerians are doing is having conversations. I don't know that that is a working strategy for the realization of the SDGs, but I observed a lot of organization around discussions, you know, and these discussions were rife with progress reports and things that were done in specific places. In particular, I observed that you would have governors from Nigeria's, some of the states in Nigeria, which are like the less talked about states, like Plateau State, Niger State, Zamfara State, which is up north. Their governors were on ground and they were pretty much in rooms where decisions were being made. And I have to really give it up to them for even staying through and having these conversations. Now, the question on how those conversations would actually drive impact back home can be debated.
Because every year we hear about these conversations. Laughing about it because we do talk a lot about conversations, but implementations and results, barely so.
That's the same thing people kept saying to me back home, because I was providing updates on social media so that people who are in the States would have a sense of what was going on here. And, you know, most people would say to me, Evelyn, all these conversations, where is the action on the ground?
So let's talk about, I was, again, Nigeria recently in Lagos. I enjoyed it. I had, you know, a great time. But one of the things that I realized was for people to get gas at the gas stations or petrol stations, you had to line up for quite a substantial amount of time. And I was wondering why, for a country that produces millions of barrels of crude oil, that you don't have gas easily accessible to the citizens. Well, what's the issue?
Jackson, there is a change that needs to happen. And that change is in the political correctness that we are practicing. One of the things I found at Onga is that nearly everyone I spoke to are diplomats. Even the politicians, when they get to the United Nations, they become diplomats. And so everybody is trying to sound politically correct. You're not trying to
massage the message.
You know, to massage the message. You know, you have to look for a nice way to say things. And even when you have objective truths that on the table, you still have to find a ribbon to, you know, make it look beautiful and sound respectful and all of that. That's exactly the bane of the problem that we're having in Nigeria, which is that how are we even sitting here having a conversation about Africa's largest economy in this type of quagmire, right? How are we discussing that Nigeria currently has the largest single train refinery in the world?
The Dangote refinery. Yes.
That's such an achievement.
Absolutely.
And we are still struggling in the way that we are. The answer to that question is political correctness, because we want to sound you know, nice. We don't want to offend anybody. We don't want to, nobody wants to be in the bad books of anybody.
Right.
And so,
but at the crux of it is what? Bad management, poor, you know, leadership?
It's a human problem.
It?
Yeah. It's definitely a human problem. And we all know it, Jackson. I don't want to be the...
Don't massage it. Give us the real truth, the real hard truth here.
It's bad leadership, definitely bad leadership. It's poor policy coordination as well. There's this disjoint scenario that I see where the leaders, the followers, the policymakers are all working in silos and everybody has an opinion, but those opinions are not aligning.
They're not converging.
There has to be a convergence and alignment of those interests for us to start seeing.
How are things in Abuja in terms of, I guess, gas? You know, I know Abuja is a little
slower. So right now in Nigeria, it doesn't matter what side of the country you're living on or in, everybody is feeling the weight of the problem. And just to put things in perspective, I have a diesel generator set in my house. At the time I got that set, like 3 years ago, I would buy a liter of diesel for about 350 naira. The week before I came into the U.S., which was last week, I bought that same liter of diesel for 1,800 naira.
Over three
from
times.
350 to 1,800.
Wow.
So you can just...
Wait, 1,800?
1,800 from 350.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yes. So you can imagine...
What created that jump? Does it have to do with the subsidies? I know the government removed subsidies on
that was the beginning.
Products.
The removal of the subsidy was more or less a domino effect that caused that to happen. What policymakers, economists, and the rest of us are unable to really understand is how even the news that there's a Dangote refinery that's, you know, coming into full operation will not solve the problem. It's not going to reduce the cost of petrol. And don't ask me why, because I don't have the answers.
Really?
Yes.
I mean, I do remember that a few months ago that Dangote, who was in the middle of completing his refinery, was already having issues with the government. I don't know what was at the center of that, but I was thinking now that you have one of the biggest refineries in the world, $20 billion worth, that things are going to be better. But you're saying that things are so bad systemically that it will take time for you to achieve, to be at a point where you can get gas easily and at a cheaper rate. Mm-hmm. That is kind of sad. Okay, let's talk about happier things. Mm. Nigeria remits, I mean, now you're here in the diaspora, I mean, in the U.S., where there's a big Nigerian diaspora. Mm-hmm. Your Nigerians remit over $20 billion.
That's right.
Number five in the world in terms of remittances. $20 billion is a big chunk of Nigeria's economy. How is the country, how is that helping the economy, first of all, like simply?
Oh, whoa. It's definitely helping the country. One of the things I try to do is a role play scenario where the diaspora does not remit any monies into the country. And just thinking about
how that would look like.
Yeah. Trust me, that's going to be a red alert situation. Mm-hmm. One question that needs to be answered, and I keep asking this question everywhere I go because I would like to see it even as a national debate, is the question on, does Nigeria have a spending problem or a revenue problem? Because you're talking about $20 billion in remittances coming into the country, and that's just one out of other sources of
revenues
that the country is getting. Mm. Yes, I do know that the economy warrants a lot of investments in critical infrastructure in order for Nigeria to grow and develop. But I'm concerned about the spending as well. And it's like, how are we investing this monies? How are we spending this monies? And who is even keeping track of those remittances? Mm. And I talk about this because that was the conversation that Nigerians in diaspora rallying around at the United Nations General Assembly were having. And I was lucky enough to be in the room where these conversations were had. And, you know, I realized that beyond the remittances and beyond sending monies home, there is a dire need for Nigerians living in the diaspora to actively participate in the engagements that are going on at home, whether that is showing up in the country, being a part of committees where this money is spent, or guiding the budgets, or even participating in some kind of infrastructure governance to ensure that, you know, these monies are spent sensibly, reasonably, and that there is impact and beyond just sending monies home. Because when you look at the data, yes, Nigeria ranks number 5, but the other countries that have high remittances, just like Nigeria, are doing better than Nigeria. And even countries that are not receiving as much are also doing better. So where are the monies going?
$20 billion, a big sum of money.
Yeah.
Again, so you're saying in terms of mobilizing, I mean, Nigerian diaspora should mobilize to influence policy and governance reforms back home. But can you give us any examples of, say, successful diaspora led advocacy efforts that you've seen in Nigeria that have led to any type of changes?
Oh, yes. I do know of some climate sustainability initiatives that's been run by the Nigerians in Diaspora organization back home, and where they come into communities that are prone to flooding to provide, you know, sensitization, to also give them tools and relief materials, even clothing. I know about another diaspora group that caters specifically to widows and young girls and provide food, monies, accommodations for them where they are struggling. I don't know how widely spread that is, but I do know that we have such pockets of such initiatives.
So you say beyond remittances, the diaspora should be more engaged and involved.
Should be more engaged, because recently the U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, Ambassador Mills in Abuja, he put out this statistic that I found rather interesting, talking about how the Nigerian diaspora community in the United States is one of the biggest, largest, and most educated groups of people. I'm proud to be a part of that group. You do know my history. I went to Georgetown.
Absolutely.
There's so many of us. But where does that end after all of this education, right? We need more Nigerians sharing their knowledge, their intellect, and beyond just like bagging all these first class degrees. We need them to send that intelligence back home to help the country grow and develop, and also lead others.
I mean, you have a great point, because I do remember that each time I've gone to either speak or attend a conference at one of these Ivy League schools, whether it's Harvard, whether it's Georgetown, your school, whether it's Columbia, Wharton School, 90% of the students that are attending the MBA program are usually Nigerians. And I'm asking myself, where does all this human capital go after here?
Right. But I have to tell
you, how does that translate?
I have to also tell you, too, because to be fair, I always find Nigeria to be a very peculiar case where is that what works in America would not necessarily work in Nigeria.
Absolutely.
And I keep asking myself, why is it? Could it be our ethnic diversity? Nigeria is so diverse in such a way that within a small community, you would find people that share, that don't share the same language. It's like a bunch of people speaking different languages. It's a bunch of people worshiping and having different belief systems. And so that level of complexity and...
I mean, the U.S. is not a homogeneous society, but look at
but
how...
But somehow it manages to act as if it
absolutely,
were.
Absolutely,
you know, I don't hear
I guess the homogeneity should be on what is our goal as a country? Where do we want to be?
Exactly.
And so for you, I guess my question is, given the current economic challenges, what is your outlook on the future of Nigeria's economy in the next 5 years? Where do you see things going, and where do you want things to be?
I think where I want things to be is definitely the way where my late dad wanted things to be, because things haven't even been where he wants it to be, and he's dead. And here I am also wanting things. And we've always wanted the same things from time immemorial, which is the basic social amenities. I am in the United States enjoying. I came into Washington, D.C. on a train from New York. As basic as that.
Smooth.
Just very basic things we're asking for.
Right.
Good transport infrastructures, good quality education. Look at me having an opportunity, an American education, and all of the doors and pathways that has opened up for me. I want a lot of young Nigerians to be able to experience the kind of freedoms, even at an intellectual level, that I have.
That was Evelyn Dan Epele. She's a Nigerian researcher and economic analyst. She joined me here in studio at the Voice of America. And with that, we come to the end of our show today. Many thanks to our guests and to you for tuning in. You can check out our previous episodes at voaafrica.com/upfront. I'm Jackson Vunganya in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead, Africa.